Hello, pals, and a particular hello to our newest Patreon, Charlie Cavendish. Welcome to the Worst Foot Forward gang. As far as we know, Charlie is our furthest afield Patreon, as she is donating to us in Australian dollars. Well, we presume that, or alternatively, there's some sort of complex tax fraud that she is involved in that means that donating to us in Australian currency is easier than donating in pound sterling. But we're going to go for the simpler answer that you are a kind Australian benefactor. So thank you so much for that. If you would like to follow in Charlie's footsteps, as ever, you can head to patreon.com/worstfootforward and donate from as little as £3 a month, which Charlie has done, all the way up to £20 a month, where you will get all sorts of exciting bonuses. And at this stage, I was just having to think about it, inspired by something another podcaster I listened to said. We've got quite the hefty back catalogue now. We are very soon going to be encroaching on episode 250. So if you're thinking, what should I give to Ben and Barry to keep the lights on and help them continue with this podcasting, how about a penny an episode? Penny an episode per month, that's £2.50 a month. If you're feeling fly, then tuppence an episode. Or if you are an insanely rich Russian oligarch who decided that it's time to divest yourself of your ill-gotten means, then £10 per episode would be very welcome indeed. But as ever, if you're able to do that and would like to do that, we would welcome you doing that. If not, reviews are very welcome. We got a couple of bangers on iTunes, and that always helps us pop up the algorithms. Or failing that, just stand on your rooftop bellowing to your locality about how much you love this podcast. It would seem that quite a lot of you have been doing that lately. In the past 10 days, we had an astonishing spike in listens. Now, there is a chance that this is due to an insane discrepancy in podcast statistic recording, but we are not going to take that very obvious worst foot forward answer and instead say hello and welcome new listeners, or alternatively hello and welcome new bots. But if you are a real live new human listener, welcome, thank you, we hope you enjoy this, and we hope you enjoy digging into our back catalogue. I think that is probably everything for now, so it is time to buckle up, make sure your sick bag is in the correct position, and get ready to join us alongside the world's worst pilot. Welcome, passengers, to Worst Foot Forward Airways, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst whilst 35,000 feet up in the air and praying that the parachutes are working. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find us furiously waggling our joystick as we try desperately not to become one with the impending mountainside. We hope that your seats are upright, your life jackets unperforated, your stewardesses all called Shirley, and your tables covered with drinks. We just want to let you know, we're all counting on you. And with me is the Red Baron to my green-faced Duke, Barry McStay.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, we'll have listeners young enough for whom this will be baffling, but you and I are of an age where, did you ever get to go up on the flight deck and visit the pilot during a commercial flight?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't understand why that's so unusual now. Is that not allowed anymore?
History happens all the time, doesn't it?
Yeah,
just, I just have such like vivid memories of being able to go up and like nearly being close enough to press some buttons as like an 8-year-old.
Well, there was also the fact that I wasn't even hugely interested in flying. It almost felt like the pilots were just going, God, I'm bored. Go get another kid.
Yeah. To be fair, that was the case. Like, the air stewards would walk down going, does anyone want to go and have a look at the flight deck? Anyone want to go visit, say hi to the pilot?
And the thing is, they were the stewardesses.
Anyone want to hijack the plane?
the stewardesses would be trying not to make eye contact with some very overeager dads. It's like, oh, you've got some painted models at home, and you've got some painted models. You look like you've got some blueprints, so best not to welcome you up.
The other thing that baffles me about that is there was like the golden age, for want of a better word, of hijacking was the 70s. And so we'd been through that, and yet in the 90s people were still like, yeah, does anyone want to come and visit the pointy end? Like, it's not like, obviously post 9/11 things changed dramatically, but already we'd had a lot of warning signs. I haven't been on a plane for quite a long time, thanks to COVID, who shall not be named. You've flown recently, haven't you?
I flew to Lanzarote with my wife and, most horrifyingly, my two children.
First time doing that?
It's my first time aboard an aircraft with two children capable of causing havoc beyond noise complaints. And it, at times, felt like I was in a four-hour-long escape room with no escape. But
do not force open any of the doors.
No. But broadly speaking, I feel like we didn't upset any of our fellow travellers, and that really is the aim.
That's the goal. You're winning at life then. Well, let me introduce our co-pilot on today's podcast. Our guest this week is, according to his website, an innovator, icon and idiot, a busy award-winning queer creative, and a multi-award-winning horse-toothed show-off who has a knack for making theatre that people actually want to watch. He is an actor, writer, director and musician whose work is full of energy, wit, fun, anger and joy, according to the Times. He's the co-artistic director of two companies, Kill the Beast and Spitlip, has composed the music for the critically acclaimed podcast series The Sync for BBC Sounds, and was my first on-screen gay kiss, which may well be the pinnacle of all his achievements. Two of his works made The Guardian's top 10 theatre show lists 2 years running. The first of these, Frankenstein, How to Make a Monster in 2018, embarked on a two-year world tour and has been adapted for TV. The second of these shows, Operation Mincemeat, remains one of the best theatre shows I've seen in the past decade. It's a musical about a covert World War II operation, full of comedy, pathos and a positive infestation of earworms. It's adored by audiences and critics alike, garnering a galaxy of stars over its multiple runs at fringe level, and it is about to transfer to the Riverside Studios in London. And if you have a choice between seeing it and the new Colin Firth movie of the same name, I bet Colin's film doesn't have as much cross-dressing or kickball changes. Inexplicably, our guest also doesn't have an agent. So let's see if appearing on this podcast raises him up or holds him below the waterline for good. Please welcome David Cumming.
Hello, 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 everybody. What a joy to be here. I did not know you were going to be scouring my website for quotes. I should have thought of that before agreeing to it. Yes, hello. I'm very excited to be here. I'm very excited to be flying the plane with you guys.
Yeah, we're going to hand over the control to you.
Great. I won't mention that I've had no training. I'm really excited. I hope that my one wins, frankly.
Yes.
I have the worst foot forward today.
So. Yeah, I think David's got a competitive streak. but I think you've got to bring your A game to this. Have you been abroad since post-COVID? Have you? I imagine the first time doing it is quite anxiety-inducing.
Yes, no, it was quite exciting. It was, where was it? I can't even remember now. But it was just weird being in a tin can. Well, I mean, it's weird being in a tin can in the air at the best of times. But then when you're like, are we all going to kill each other? Because we've all secretly got it. And it's like the longest time you've sat next to someone you've never met before for the past 2 years. And you've all got masks on and being like, is this okay?
Yeah.
But I, you know, obviously flying, bad for the environment. But I quite enjoy flying sometimes when you forget that you're in the air and you can just accept that everything's going to be fine and that the clouds look beautiful. But then you have those moments when you just like wake up from a nap and you suddenly get the fear of God in you, that you're like, what on earth am I doing? Why am I up in the sky? I'm not a bird. I cannot cope here. And you just have to kind of quietly calm yourself down or just freak the hell out, I suppose.
I quite enjoyed flying as a kid, and then I think I have a very vivid memory of my older brother sort of saying, as we were sat beside each other on the plane on holidays one year, that there's just a thin sheet of metal between you and 30,000 feet of open air. And from then on, I found flight so terrifying.
I think the thing is, you know, when you meet and talk to pilots or members of the military or engineers or scientists and you go, gosh, what a very straightforward, reliable human being you are, with clearly zero imagination.
Yeah.
That is the difference between them and us. We are obviously tiny little engines of imagination, which broadly speaking is good for our career, but specifically speaking, it's not that great for things like intercontinental travel.
Yeah.
Because I can imagine all of the ways in which an aeroplane flight would go wrong, and indeed how I would then survive that to then die alone in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, you don't want to hear that your pilot is creative. You want them to be methodical.
Yeah, exactly. Almost robotic. I was once on a flight and we were being held, you know, when they're like, oh, we have to go around again, there's no space to land. And you're like, what? And the guy next to us, the guy was like, there's all the floor. the guy next to us, who, you know, he claimed to be, it's fine, I work in, we had no proof that this wasn't just him absolutely razzing us. And he got us good because he was like, oh, well, it's all to do with, basically, it's like they queue up and ultimately you just have to hope that you don't run out of petrol. I was like, well, if that's the case, they'll definitely make us land. He was like, no, it goes on size of aircraft, not how many passengers are inside of it, because ultimately it's about the insurance. So, like, they would rather lose a cheaper plane that's full than a big plane that's half empty. I was like, oh, what the? And we were in, like, a tiny, like, easy jet flight or something. And we were like, what? He was like, yeah. So we'd be one of the first to, like, go, because they'd be like, well, that's a cheap aircraft that wouldn't cost that much to reinsure. So there you go, guys. Extra fear if you ever need it. Flying cheaply, you will be the first to just be, well, drop out of the sky once.
Another reason to avoid Ryanair then going forward. You're very good at inducing anxiety in fellow travelers, we discovered. What are you worst at in the world, David?
What am I worst at? Many things, but I think annoyingly, and I hate this about myself, I'm the worst at proofreading my emails. And it's such a boring thing to be worst at, but I spend about 20 minutes, every time, just checking through, really methodically checking something, and then just before I send it, I'll make a slight tweak and then just not notice that I've done that. And so every email, almost every email I send comes through with some kind of really idiotic, like a sentence will just stop halfway through, and then someone will be like, sorry, can you just clarify that bit where you just... Stop talking to me.
Are you doing that thing? Are you doing that thing at the moment? Because, like I said, you're not represent. Inexplicably, you don't have an agent. Are you doing that thing where you're writing to loads of agents, which I have done in the past, and you have a standard letter format, which you then copy and paste from email to email, and on occasion will forget to change the dear Ben to dear David.
It's just the worst.
And then they know exactly. Doesn't matter how tailored you've tried to make the email look, they know exactly what you're doing.
You're like, oh god. All that up. So that's my really boring thing that I'm not very good at.
You're so multi-talented, it has to be something really boring. A couple of pilot facts I read about just to get us going. Pilots and co-pilots get different food from one another. Yeah, because they don't want to risk food poisoning. Taking them both down.
Oh, I don't want to risk someone getting above their station.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the pilot gets a 3-course meal with wine. The co-pilot gets pot noodle.
Gets the bones.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
And they get different food from the passengers as well, just to really try and make sure there's no cross-contamination of meals. And they have a whole preparation period beforehand. There's 2 hours prep. The pilots do a quick, a medical checkup and blood pressure before taking off, all of these things just to make sure they're fit to fly. Yeah. Right. But then also I sort of go, well, why don't tube drivers and bus drivers get this sort of same thing? Yeah, well, essentially, they're in charge of a lot.
I mean, I suppose you can stop a tube and you're not going to kill everyone.
Yeah. To be fair, just handbrake the airplane.
Okay.
They also speak.
Extra nice food?
I don't know. You'd hope so, wouldn't you? You'd hope so. They have a lot of authority, pilots. They're captains. They're allowed to write fines. They can arrest people in air. Yeah, if they can fine passengers for breaking air law, I imagine.
They can win.
At what point does it become the captain's jurisdiction? Like, if we're only 200 foot off the ground, does that still belong to the local police force? But as we hit, 3,000 feet, should the captain come over the comms and be like, okay, people, this is your captain speaking, just so you know, this is my town now.
Yeah, if the passenger is jumping while committing the fine, then the captain's in charge of them.
Yeah.
They can also take wills. If a passenger is dying, a pilot has sort of notary authority. Yeah. They also speak a special type of English. I didn't realise this. All pilots worldwide, commercial airlines certainly, speak aviation English. So they all speak a version of English, whether they're in Asia or Africa or the Americas or Europe. So they can avoid accidents and be aware of each other and communicate to each other smoothly. And this, they sort of have words, like special words. So when you hear a pilot say niner, that's the thing they say, rather than the number nine, they say niner so that it isn't confused with other single syllable English words that rhyme with nine.
So
like fine or whatever. I'm writing a fine, I'm writing a niner. Fine. Yeah. instead of yes or no, they say negative, and they don't say affirmative, they say affirm. Rather than, films and TV, they sort of say affirmative, but it's affirm is what they usually say.
How do you say, like, last summer I went to France and made a friend?
Yeah, they need to do like an oral test in aviation English. they also say Wilco. You know what Wilco means? You always say Roger Wilco.
Not a clue.
It's Will Comply. It's short for Will Comply.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Comply sounds like it's a very request from a terrorist sort of word, isn't it?
Yeah, it very much is.
do you comply, McStay?
Compliance.
Saying that all pilots are air terrorists.
Yeah. it's like we said, it's Chinatown up there, David. It's the Wild West. And if they make a mistake, they don't just go back and, you know, correct themselves. They actually have to say the word correction ahead of the word that was incorrect. To make it very clear. So it's basically it's a whole language. They take tests in it and everything. I stuck the word worst pilot into the internet just to see what would come up, and this story appeared on Quora. A former pilot called Ron Wagner described a US-based captain that he nicknamed Captain Zero, who, in an early flight on board a Boeing 727, this guy, Captain Zero, quietly and with no warning reached up and dropped the landing gear. While they were at 35,000 feet.
He just wanted to see what would happen.
Yeah, he literally said, I just wanted to see what was happening.
So this goes back to my original point. The last thing you want to hear over the comms is a captain just going, sorry, I was just trying something.
Yeah, it's mad. And he was, you know, the airline grounded him and wanted to fire him, but the Airline Pilots Association got him reinstated, and he was made a captain. So he was first mate at this point, and he was made a captain afterwards. And so he was flying another 727, where he decided to pull some basically fighter pilot evasive maneuvers. He claimed that a flying saucer was coming towards them and they'd have crashed into it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
He was grounded again, and the ALPA again got him reinstated. And this time he was taking off at Ronald Reagan National Airport in Washington. And on runway 36, it's pointed directly at the White House. And obviously, you take off and you immediately turn left, fly northeast. And this guy basically decided, he sort of mentioned to his co-pilots, I wonder what would happen if I just took off and kept flying straight ahead and dove at the White House.
What?
Yeah. He was the sort of person who, you know, when we've all had the moment where you're on the tube platform, you go, God, I hope I don't jump in front of the tube.
Yeah, like, of course.
But he would voice those thoughts.
Right, okay. And then did he go ahead and do that? Or were they like, please do not do that?
No, he didn't get it, but he did lose his job, but not for being fired. Really? The airline went bankrupt.
Well, yeah, I mean, if he's driving the plane to not where it's meant to be, then of course it went bankrupt.
Yeah, exactly. I read a little bit about Howard Hughes, the aviator, and I didn't realise quite how important an aviator he was. He broke a lot of records at the time. He broke the record for flying a plane over land. He travelled 352 miles an hour in one plane in 1935. He also set a record for the transcontinental US speed. He drove from Burbank, California to Newark, New Jersey in just 7 hours, 28 minutes. And on July the 10th, 1938, he set off with a 4-man crew to break the circumnavigation record. So they circumnavigated the globe in 3 days, 19 hours and 17 minutes, for which he got a ticker tape parade in New York City.
non-stop? No, not non-stop,
but in terms of, like, actually traveling around the globe. That would have been pretty... 3.5 days, even now.
Wait, what?
Yeah. But even at the time, the journey that they took, they refueled in Paris, Moscow, Omsk, and Yakutsk, both in Siberia, and in Minneapolis as well. But do you know why he did a little stop by Old Saybrook in Connecticut? He did a little wing dip over there.
Is that the place where the Wright brothers flew the first plane?
No, that's Kittiwake. He dipped his wings at the house of his girlfriend, Catherine Hepburn.
Whoa, wait, what?
That is a baller move.
And now dipping his wings is not a euphemism. I just want to be clear about
that. What does dipping a wing mean?
You sort of tilt the plane from side to side, like giving a little wave with the plane.
Oh my gosh. I mean, what a sentence.
Yeah, like, absolutely. That, what, yeah.
Like that on your gravestone is just like, that's enough, isn't it?
You're that's the richest man in the world. You're dipping the wings of your plane at your film star girlfriend as you're about to break the circumnavigation record.
Yeah, that is true baller.
Yeah,
that
all is. In a Friday for Howard Hughes.
Wow.
And do you know what his famous plane was made out of? The one that he's most famous for?
Tins of mackerel.
Fans of The Simpsons should know this.
Oh,
he was hired by the US government to design and build an aircraft that could carry 700 troops or a load of 60 tons to help the war effort during World War II. It was known as the H-4 Hercules, the Flying Boat, or the Spruce Goose. Which is a nickname that Howard Hughes absolutely hated. So the Mr. Burns' Spruce Moose in The Simpsons is a reference to this. It had a wingspan of 320 feet, was the largest aircraft ever constructed at the time, and he made it out of wood to make it light enough to carry the massive load it was going to be carrying. But it wasn't actually made of spruce. It was made of birch. But spruce doesn't rhyme with birch doesn't rhyme with goose, so they had to call it that instead.
When do we hate it? It's wrong on every level.
Yeah, right. And it only ever flew once. The war ended before it was finished, basically. And he actually had to testify to before Senate committees saying that he hadn't wasted all of their money. but he did demonstrate it in 1947 in a flight above some water in Long Beach, California. It's now in an aviation museum in Oregon.
Cool.
But yeah, I read mainly about aviation first to find my World War's pilot, because I wanted to go back to the early flights. You mentioned the Wright brothers, Ben. They're not the first humans to fly. There were obviously the Fairmont Gaultier are the brothers who invented hot air ballooning in the 1700s. And the first passenger on board with them, the Montgolfiers, flew on a tethered balloon with a chap called Jean-François Pilatre de Rosier, who was a science teacher. And they basically didn't know if humans could withstand the rigors of being in the air, so they had experimented with some animals beforehand as well.
What did they put up?
I think a duck was one of them. You know, ducks already can fly, so it feels like a bit of a...
I feel like you don't need to tell one. It's got wings, like, probably it's all right in the air.
Yeah, it can't already... That's not really the insight they wanted. Interestingly, the first... known fatality in an air crash was also Jean-François Pilatre de Rosier. So he went up in a tethered balloon and then in an untethered balloon, and then he was flying with a chap called Pierre Roman in a Rosier balloon near Calais. They were attempting to cross the Channel in 1785, and he perished in that particular crash.
There was a couple of things that were absolutely nuts about some of his earlier flights. On his on the second flight, there were four French nobles aboard who paid for the trip, so sort of like a space tourist.
Nice.
And one of the biggest problems they had to overcome was that the outer envelope of the balloon was covered in expensive wallpaper, which became wet and came loose because of the air conditions. The hot air that got the balloon up there was heated by wood in an iron stove, which was set on fire with brandy. And that was only after... previous tests had involved pouring brandy onto potatoes. So I was amazed that they didn't in the end sort of do a crepe Suzette to get it off the ground.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, the nobles are there, they're just like, oh, we got loads of that brandy. Let's just get that fire going.
It's not even the best brandy.
Why wallpaper was what was that like a papier mâché thing? But
I think it was just decorative.
Yeah. Yeah, basically as soon as hot air balloons became a thing, decorating them and making them look pretty was a thing as well. Like making a big spectacle of them, drawing
nice
more.
Suppose,
draw more crowds.
There was also a debate about who should fly the first ever hot air balloon. You mentioned a duck, I think you said. The very first untethered flight was involved a sheep, a cockerel, and a duck, and was apparently being piloted by a riddle. But there was a debate that actually the first manned flight should contain two condemned criminals because they were so afraid of what would happen if man went up that far. But de Rozier persuaded the king that, you know, he basically got the say over this, that no, it should be an honourable thing to be one of the first human to have flown. And so it should be a trained balloonist, not a cut purse.
Well, certainly disasters and deaths were very much a feature of a lot of the early hot air balloonings. 1785 saw the first aviation disaster. Tullamore, County Offaly, a hot air balloon crashed into a house and set it on fire, and the fire spread and eventually burned down 100 houses.
Oh, gosh.
And the first women to fly were the Marchioness, again, with the aristocracy, the Marchioness and Countess of Montalembert, the Countess of Podenas, and Miss de Lagarde, who ascended in a tethered balloon in Paris in 1784. I also liked another early balloonist, Jean-Pierre Blanchard. He was the first to cross the English Channel in 1785 alongside an American called John Jeffreys. And then Blanchard conducted the first ever balloon flights in the Americas. He launched a balloon in Pennsylvania. And apparently the witnesses to that flight in that day included President George Washington, and future presidents John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe, all there to witness this first balloon flight. And Blanchard, he was also one of the first to try parachuting. The parachute had been invented about a decade beforehand, and so Blanchard thought, the parachute had been invented a couple of years beforehand, and so Blanchard thought, I'll demonstrate parachutes by dumping out of my balloons. His first parachute demonstrations were conducted with a dog as the passenger. As so often on this podcast, dogs end up getting in the firing line for people's experiments. He married, Blanchard, a woman called Marie-Madeleine Sophie Armand, or Sophie Blanchard. And when Pierre died, Sophie basically kept demonstrating balloons afterwards to support herself. She was the first woman to pilot her own balloon, which she did in 1805, and she was the first woman to be killed in an aviation accident when she died in 1819.
What a trailblazer.
I know, literally.
Yes.
And she literally lived in the air.
Yeah. A couple more before my choice. The first manned glider flight. I just like this from Wikipedia. The first manned glider flight was made by an unnamed boy in an uncontrolled glider launched by George Cayley in 1853.
That sounds like a recipe for hot chaos.
Yeah. Unnamed boy in an uncontrolled flight. You there, boy, sit in this machine. Why, mister?
You boy, what day is this? Why, it is your lucky day, because you're going up in an uncontrolled flight. Now, fetch me a turkey. But turkeys are flightless. A turkey, I said.
Yeah. And the Wright brothers' achievement should probably be called the first manned-powered, heavier-than-air, controlled flight. There's a lot of qualifiers, because the first...
Qualifiers, very nice.
Qualifiers, yeah. The first powered flight, there was a guy called Henri Giffard who invented steam-powered airships, which had, you know, large dirigibles with a platform and a steam engine below them. His airship wasn't powerful enough to fly against the wind, so he didn't make a return journey on his first ever demonstration. And a guy called Clement Adair went half the length of a football field in a sort of a bat-winged glider thing, which is manned and powered and heavier than air, in 1890. So the Wright brothers' flight in 1903 came after all of these. But my world's worst pilot, I am going to nominate... I'm going to nominate a chap called Pierre Testu-Brissy, who made a flight from Belleville Park in Paris. And this flight is particularly notable in 1798 because it was the first ever balloon ascent on horseback.
Excuse me?
What?
Brissy was a real, like, showman. He made a lot of money, like, from demonstrating hot air balloons. He flew for 11 hours in an electrical storm on one occasion with an iron rod in the basket to draw lightning towards the balloon.
Absolutely not.
I know, he flew these enormous balloons, really huge balloons, which people would flock to chase and see them. So he ended up having to pay compensation to people, to farmers whose crops were trampled by these crowds and things like that. And so, yeah, in 1798, he came up with another wheeze, which is he built a platform beneath his balloon, and it was a large elongated balloon looking like more like an airship. It had a rectangular platform, and he sat astride his balloon. The horse was not tethered. He had trained the horse to be perfectly calm no matter whatever situation it was in.
Had he?
So he said, and Test Tube Brissy ascended at Bellevue, and the experiment apparently did not meet his expectations, so he tried a few days later and succeeded beyond expectations. He landed a bit further away on a plane in Nanterre, and the horse, standing perfectly still, I think this is the bit I don't enjoy and the reason I want to make him the world's worst pilot, is you've got a horse standing apparently perfectly calmly, but with blood bleeding through its nostrils and its ears.
Why?
Well, apparently the air pressure didn't agree with the horse and it didn't have a fisherman's friend to suck on. So, I mean, another pioneer of ballooning and an important figure, no doubt. But for putting a poor bloodied horse...
Pioneer of horse torture as well, by the sounds of it.
Pioneer of horse torture, exactly. For pioneering a horse torture while in the air.
What was the point in this? When he was like, this experiment didn't go... What was he hoping it would show? Just that
David, you do our podcast long enough, you will learn that humans will learn a thing, and then the first things they will do is, can we eat this? Can we fuck this? And can we make an animal suffer with this? Are the sort of the first three stops on the train.
You really are the greatest of all creations.
Yeah. And anything we can eat, fuck, and torture an animal with, then humankind will have ascended. Pierre Test Tube Brissy is my world's worst pilot, Ben.
Very good. Yeah, how do you say Test Tube Brissy?
Pierre Test Tube Brissy.
Test Tube Brissy. Lovely stuff. David, what are you bringing to the aerodrome?
So I have a unassuming gentleman during the Second World War named Major William Martin. The reason why I think he can be classed as the world's worst pilot is that his one and only flight that he ever made crashed into the sea after about an hour or so in a fatal accident. Not only is that sad, but also to be expected, given that this major had never been to pilot school, had never learned how to fly a plane, and in fact had been dead for 4 months when the flight took off.
So what you're saying is he was the ultimate kamikaze pilot.
He'd got the job done and then got in the air.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, okay. So yeah, just a very efficient kamikaze pilot.
Yeah. He'd misread which order to do it in.
I've done all the right kamikaze, but not necessarily in the right order.
Exactly. That would be the world's worst pilot in my humble opinion. But the story behind that is that, in fact, this person didn't exist as such. The body existed, but the story around who that person was is not true. And Major William Martin was a creation by MI5 during World War II, a fake soldier that they created using the body of a Welsh homeless man who had died in January 1943. And they floated his body off the coast of Spain in April 1943, making it look like he had been a pilot who had crashed into the sea whilst delivering documents to important documents that suggested that the Allied forces were going to attack in Sardinia instead of Sicily in an attempt to get Hitler to move all of his troops to the wrong place. So it's all this big ruse. But on paper, and for many, many, many years, it looked like a man called Major William Martin had just accidentally crashed into the sea and ultimately lost Britain the war through these documents.
This is Operation Mincemeat, as you say.
The story of Operation Mincemeat and the central figure.
And this major, he is the man who wasn't there. That's his other title.
Yes, the man who never was. It was the title. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yes, the man who never was but was there. It's very different to the man who was there, but no, the man who wasn't there but was. Sorry, yeah. I've ended up in a Lewis Carroll riddle, and I don't know how to get out again. I mean, I feel like there's going to be a hot air balloon with a duck, a cockerel, and a sheep is going to come and rescue me.
So set the scene for us. The Allies wanted to invade Italy from North Africa, and their route was essentially through one of the Italian islands, isn't it?
So Sicily had by this point been taken over by the Nazis, and it was the only way to get back to mainland Europe was via Sicily. It was the only viable option, and as you say, coming from North Africa. So they had to shift the German troops out of Sicily, but the only way to do that was to get them to think that the Allied forces were going to attack somewhere else. So they chose Sardinia because it was like the next best place that might make sense. Also, it transpired that Hitler himself had this weird bee in his bonnet being like, I think they're going to do Sardinia, guys. And everyone's like, why would they ever do that? That's really dumb. But it just so
happened. Call it gut instinct.
Yeah, exactly. So it played
pure intuition.
Yeah, exactly. His drug-addled intuition. So they were like, how can we convince him to move his troops? And there had been a previous idea based on a kind of murder mystery plot in a book that Ian Fleming of James Bond fame had found and was like, oh, this is a great idea. Like, take a body, make it look like an officer of the army or the navy and have secret documents on it and then pass them to the enemy. And then a few months prior to Operation Mincemeat happening, where they staged all this, in fact, an actual British soldier did wash up on the shore and did have secret documents, but they weren't that important and they just changed the mission. But it had actually already happened, which somewhat, you know, gave credence to what they're about to do. But also it's like, guys, don't, you know, if it's already happened once, people might get a little.
It's almost too coincidental. Yeah.
Yeah. But in the end, they went for it and they essentially stole a body of a homeless man who a Welsh man called Glyndwr Michael, who had very sadly died whilst homeless. He had eaten some bread covered in rat poison. Now, no one knows whether or not he did that to commit suicide or he was just extremely hungry and found some bread that someone had left rat poison on.
Or do we know whether the Ministry of Defence was playing the long game and was just leaving bits of bread covered in rat poison out around city centres of London going, we're going to get a bite at some point, lads, and then we mobilise.
Goes right to the top.
I mean, given everything else they're up to, really would not surprise me if this came out. They're like, oh, actually, we've declassified even more documents. Turns out every death you've ever known has been a ruse. So then they nicked this body
It had to be a body that was like the right sort of age and the right build, the right sort of level of fitness-ish, and also that he could conceivably have drowned. Was that the
other thing as well? Yes, and so they kind of got it signed off by a man called... Well, they got it got found by... It, sorry. Glyndwr Michael was found by a coroner called Bentley Purchase, who was like, I think I've got someone here who you could use, because he'd been asked to find a body. And then they got it checked out by a man called Spilsbury, who is his own... person, I'm sure he has his own. Do you know this guy?
Having seen Operation Mincemeat and read a bit about him, we have to do World's Worst Coroner just so we can talk about him.
Indeed, just for him. I'm not going to ruin that by talking too much, but
yeah. I'm just enjoying the name so much, like Spilsbury and Bentley Purchase. Oh. It does. If you could make up the most wartime British names possible, then you would sort of discount these as being a little bit too on the nose.
Yeah, isn't it mad that Bentley Purchase sounds less like someone buying a car than an aristocrat?
It's so true. And the names of the men who came up with the plan, Ewan Montague and Charles Cholmondeley, it's so British. It's ridiculous. And that Charles is who I play in the show in our musical version of Operation Mincemeat. But yeah, so they asked this man called Spilsbury, and I won't ruin your future episodes, but he is a very interesting man who was akin to being like, he was like the real life Sherlock Holmes. He did a lot of stuff. Basically, the concept of CSI, like crime scene investigation, comes from him. And he was like, guys, maybe we shouldn't just like, like touch all the bodies of a crime scene and just like wash it all down before I investigate first. And like, oh, cool, great idea. But then also he in later life claimed he could do certain things, like smell corpses and be like, oh yeah, that guy got killed by his wife. You're like, sorry, what? He's like, yeah, I smelled him. I smelt him and I can tell that. You're like, oh, you're mad, aren't you? You're right.
Yeah, he began to believe his own bullshit.
Yeah. Indeed.
Oh, I thought you were going to say his catchphrase was like, I smelt him and now I have dealt him.
Indeed. And yeah, they asked this guy and he was like, it's fine. They'll never notice that he didn't drown. And so, yeah, they chucked him in the sea and floated him off the coast of Spain. And luckily...
It was a submarine mission, wasn't it, to actually deliver the body?
Submarine mission, yeah. So there was no plane that they, you know, they just floated the body off and were like, oh, we just make it look like he had crashed.
But the amazing thing is we mentioned this last week, and they announced the death of this guy in the newspapers on the same day. We mentioned last week. On the same day, the actor Trevor Howard's death was announced. He was in a plane that was shot down by the Luftwaffe, and Trevor Howard was a very famous actor in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. And so in the same copy of the Times has his death and the death announcement of Bill Martin, yeah. And they concocted a whole backstory for him and everything.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in his wallet, they had stuff. How do I explain this? They created something called wallet litter, which is the stuff that you just have, that you just accumulate in your wallet to make, like, if you put a wallet together, it's just got cards in, well, not cards by then, but whatever. You'd be like, oh, that doesn't look like a real wallet. You need like weird receipts that someone's forgotten about and left in there for months. And so they built up this whole fake thing by going out on the town as him and getting kind of receipts in his name, and then had letters from his fake dad being like, you need to stop spending money, son. I'm running out of money. They went and signed his name on a guest book of a hotel as if he'd gone and done it. But it was like on the other side of England, just in case someone went and checked
this
veracity of this man. Yeah, it's kind of amazing that they did this. It's really it's like high end, like character creation. It's like really high end D&D, but it's really laughing to the hunt at nth degree.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put it past the special operations executive to go, do you know what? We're going to invent Dungeons and Dragons 40 years early, but we're going to invent it in a way that the dice rolls have real life effects. Like basically, the only reason we got away and won World War II is just we kept rolling natural 20s on initiative from 1942 to 1945.
And it's a very, like, I mean, as writers, you create characters and name characters and come up with their backstories all the time. The stakes behind this, though.
Hugely. And they were like kind of taking the piss, really, like, in some senses that, like, the photo of the girl in the wallet was one of the women working on the with Jean, one of the secretaries working on the plan. They were just like, you look great. Actually, what they did was they got all the women in the office to bring in photos of them and do a parade in there of like, who's the sexiest photo? And they it was like, guys, this feels did you need to do that?
Now we need the swimwear around.
Basically, like, and then off out in town they bought a diamond, a fake diamond ring, well, a real diamond ring, and just to get the receipt. It's like, where did the ring end up? It's like, I don't know, I just kept it, but we needed the receipt ultimately.
The expenses scandals.
But yeah, it was all very, there was a lot of fun going on in that office whilst they were having to really, really do something quite serious. And it was kind of the last ditch attempt at this deception, really. The British didn't have many other things on the plate of that might actually work. But of course, if it went wrong, then, I mean, the everything would be absolutely ballsed up because Hitler would know, like, well, this is obviously fake. Obviously, they're about to attack us in Sicily.
Yeah. So it nearly did go wrong, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Like, many, many, many. Like, more than you could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
But thankfully, it didn't. And that's why we're still here today. Discussing that. So yeah, that would be my world's worst pilot. I mean, an honest caveat, he's not real, so it doesn't count. And two, he didn't actually fly the plane, so is he? But on paper, somewhere, he is technically a pilot.
Yeah, I think that's also fair. And that, I mean, obviously there's the ethical issues around, which you touch on in the musical, which is, you know, they've just taken this body of this guy. Did anyone notify his family? There's no consent involved in, like, your body being used in this way. And there's the aftermath as well, which is the film by Montague, which I just love as a little, like, obviously there's a film being made about this story at the moment. There's your musical. Yeah. The film has been done.
The film has been done by Ewan Montague himself, who was obsessed with everyone knowing that he'd done this, FYI. And just in case you've noticed, it's definitely a secret World War II mission. And he's like, you'll never believe what we just did. It's like, can you shut up, Charlie?
I mean, psychologically, that is very similar to the makeup of serial killers who are like, I'm going to do this awful thing, but you must know that it's me who has committed it.
Yeah.
He was really angry that the British government would not let the story be told. He was writing letters all the time, being like, guys, my book is ready to go. It is ready to go. Cut, print, let's get this made. And they were like, it's a secret World War II mission. You can't admit that this is what happened. But then a journalist got hold of it, or got hold of the story, and was a bit like, this doesn't really make sense. What actually happened here? And in order to prevent the real, genuine truth coming out, the government said okay to Ewan Montague, and he was able to publish his book that year. It was in the early 50s. I think it was 52. And yeah, so he put his very sanitized account, which says that it was all him, because the other guy, Charles Chumley, didn't want, he was still working for MI5. He was like, you might ruin my career if you point out I'm a secret operative. So
yeah.
And then in it, they say that, oh, we found an ex-serviceman and told his family and it was all above board. It was not at all. And yeah, there is something really poignant and quite sad, actually. I mean, not only in the stealing of the body itself, but also the fact that this was a homeless man who came from a working class family in Wales. He'd had a really tough life and had kind of fallen through the cracks of the establishment, who didn't really care about him when he was alive. And then the second he's dead, they're like, great, now you're useful.
Yeah.
Now you can help us prop up this system that didn't help you, which is quite strange and upsetting in some senses. And Monty was, you know, a bit cavalier, I'd say, ultimately, about the whole thing. But he did end up on an American talk show sitting next to a chimp and discussing. This is there's a great photo of him. Like, I can't remember what talk show it is, but he's sitting next to a chimp. So he was one of two guests, and the other one was a chimp.
That is so good.
That is absolutely one of those eventualities where you go, life is a simulation.
Yeah. He then did go on to become a very well-known and respected British judge. But he's from an the established set of Britain. He's a very famous British Jewish man who has a lot of like important support for the Jewish community as well. But he also was the man behind
The things I really love about him is he wrote and appeared in the film, or there was the film adaptation of this, of his book, which he appeared in. And I also, just from reading his Wikipedia, he was the first cousin once removed of Christopher Guest.
I did not know that, really.
Yeah, apparently so.
He also, I mean, his family were bonkers. They, his one of his brothers invented ping pong, invented ping tennis. And together they were obsessed with cheese, and they had a cheese society, him and his brother, and they employed some men to go out and try and milk a whale to get the first ever. There's so much going on.
I'm sorry, David. You're now just picking character traits at random from a bingo card in front of you. This is all very well when you're devising theatre, but I will not have it as serious history. Pick a maximum of three character traits and stick to them. You can't end your section of the show by going, oh, by the way, they attempted to milk a whale.
I mean, you're quite right, Ben. In fact, in the show, we have had to scale back a lot of this insanity, because people, in initial feedback, what they were like this, who were just like, you can't lie. You can't lie like this, guys. We're like, we're not, but okay.
Yeah, because the show is quite like comedic and very comedic and madcap. And so there is that element that you're telling a true story. It doesn't need any embellishment because it's already mad enough. I was wondering, was it blue cheese from the blue whale?
Barry spoke about some of the pioneers of early manned flight, but he has missed a couple out. First of all, I would like to talk about Abu Nazir Ismail ibn Hamad al-Jarari, who was a Turkish lexicographer and author of a particularly notable Arabic dictionary, who lived in the late 10th century, early 11th century, who may have been one of the first humans to have attempted flight. He attempted flight from the roof of a mosque, possibly because the article I read, due to delusions of being a bird.
Oh, no.
Okay. Yes.
Oh, this is the guy with he made feathered wings, didn't he?
Yes, he did. So he's almost like an Arabic Daedalus.
Yeah.
So I looked him up and I enjoyed that. And the other one I looked up is the
caveat, the ending to all of these early ones, by the way, is they were injured while landing.
Yeah. Yes. Making them both like a bad aircraft and a bad pilot.
Yeah.
There's also a chap called Bladud, who was the Flying King of Bath, who was written about by Geoffrey of Monmouth. And according to Geoffrey, this chap Bladud lived in the 9th century BC. He built the town of Caerbardon, which went on to become Bash. And Bladud was a magician who taught necromancy throughout the realm of Britain. Not great. And in part of his experiments, he built a pair of wings and apparently succeeded in flying as far as the Temple of Apollo in the town of Trinovantum, or London, where he crashed and was dashed into countless fragments.
Well, he shattered.
Yes.
Wow.
Made of glass?
So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That glass dude from Bath, glass. Yeah.
So, I mean, clearly, nonsense. There's no way you can fly directly from Bath to London. The flight path doesn't exist.
You have to stop off at Cambridge, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But I enjoyed him. Now, I'm sure you both struggle with this. Quite hard to talk about the world's worst pilots without things getting pretty bleak pretty quickly.
Yes.
I found a couple that are just the right side of bleak. We talked at the start of this show about... why would you allow a child on a flight deck? Well, on the 23rd of March 1994, the captain of Aeroflot Flight 593, Yaroslav Kudrinsky, invited his two children into the cockpit and let them sit at the controls. Mm-hmm. Now, that bit is against airline regulations. His 15-year-old son, Eldar Kudrinsky, accidentally disconnected the autopilot, causing the plane to bank to the right before diving. The co-pilot brought up the plane too far, causing it to stall and started a flat spin. So the eventual crash and death of everyone on board technically was not the fault of the children. It was the fault of the co-pilot, who overcompensated.
But no. that child is grounded.
Yes. 100%.
Sorry, I'm not proud of myself at all.
I can see in your eyes, you were just like, oh dear.
Oh no. But the worst, I don't know if it's better or worse, it was a 15-year-old, because like it put a toddler on you. Toddlers are always grabbing stuff as well. You wear a necklace around a toddler and they're going to grip it. So, you know, it's not going to be...
I feel a 15-year-old should have known better than to touch anything there.
Yeah, maybe so.
Father should have known better than to let his 15-year-old...
Let's be fair though. If you were, I mean, in our 30s, if we were on a flight deck, there's all those buttons. The innate human urge to want to push a button is so strong.
Oh, it's overwhelming, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's also there's so many. I swear, half of those disco lights are just there for show.
Yeah.
Probably that many things. Like forward, back, up, down. Chill out.
Yes. We've all played a flight simulator.
The thing is, as well, is like, because, you know, once the hard bit is the taking off and sitting down. And
sitting down? Do you mean landing?
I mean landing.
Well, when you're at our age, you're quite right.
Sit, stay.
I think the aviation round in Crufts is remarkable. Next up, I looked at a flight, Flight 173, that flew on the 28th of December 1978. A flight simulator instructor captain allowed his plane to run out of fuel while investigating a landing gear problem. Now, what had happened here is that he was running on simulator instructor time rather than pilot time. And apparently those are two different things. And so in the future, United Airlines had to calculate in extra time just in case people made that mistake. It was basically the contributing factor they thought was that an instructor can control the amount of fuel in simulator training so that it never runs out. So clearly,
he thought his airplane had infinite fuel.
Yeah, pretty much. He thought he had a cheat code going on.
Yeah. Up, down, left, right, A, B.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Next, I discovered a pilot who was flying from North Carolina to New York. He left the controls to go to the bathroom, absolutely fine. And he attempted to leave the bathroom and return to the cockpit, but found himself locked inside. So he started crying for help, at which point a passenger who had gone to use the toilet heard that. And discovered that the person inside the toilet was the captain. The captain said, listen, go to the cockpit. This is the password to get in to the cockpit door. So the passenger goes to the cockpit door, starts knocking on it, saying the pilot is trapped and is shouting the password. Here's the problem. This is in America, and the passenger is from, you guessed it, the Middle East. So all the co-pilot can hear is a heavily accented Middle Eastern voice banging on the cockpit door, giving the passwords to get in. So he asked Mission Control what to do, and they said, oh, you need to do an emergency landing because you're about to be hijacked.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh.
Was there literally no other staff on this plane?
Apparently not. There were flights were scrambled into the air to prevent hijacking.
And fighters and stuff.
Yeah.
No way.
This has a pathetic ending in that finally the pilot managed to get out of the toilet and go, we're fine, we're all fine, it's all good. But for those 10 minutes, that was potentially one of the greatest stories ever.
Oh my gosh.
They need like a little intercom in that toilet so the captain can speak to the co-pilot.
Oh, that's going to be abused though, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're in there and you're just going to press that button really loud farts.
God, that's horrific. And also hilarious at the same time.
Yes, it is.
Anyone getting trapped in a toilet is almost always funny, yeah.
It is. My penultimate suggestion is two pilot support Air Berlin. They were landing in October 2017 on an Airbus A330, and it was the airline's last transatlantic flight, so they wanted to make a mark with a dignified and emotional goodbye for that particular airline. And how do they do that? Do they make a small announcement, perhaps they have a little bit of bubbly on landing, or did they bank sharply to the left, fly low over the airport, extremely close to the control tower, to do a honorary lap of honor of the airport they were landing at? That's right, they went for that one.
Why?
Because that's what they thought they should do.
I'm sorry, you don't bring games into on the last day of pilot school. That's not what you do.
Had they put it in their flight plan? Were they like, yeah.
Squiggly bit at the end.
Just like, oh, don't worry about that bit. What?
Yeah. Sorry, the pen slipped.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. No. They just went for it. They just decided that's.
Fuck you, humans shouldn't be in charge of anything.
No, they really shouldn't. I mean, you'll be glad to know that they were struck off.
They fucking cared. They were leaving their jobs.
Well, no. Just that was the end for that particular airline. That doesn't mean they're never going to be pilots again.
Okay, fine, good.
They were just trying to sign off with style, and a little bit too much style and not enough substance in what they were doing.
Yeah, that's true.
But my nominee for the world's worst pilot goes to the pilot of a plane flying in January 2011, the first officer on an Air Canada flight from Toronto to Zurich. He decided to get to have a nap because he was feeling tired. Again, absolutely fine. That's what co-pilots and autopilot is there for. An hour later, he woke up, clearly still a little bit groggy, and he overheard a pilot calmly and matter-of-factly mention that there was an American military aircraft in the vicinity. Again, no big deal. He looked out of the front window and noticed what appeared to be the exterior lights from an oncoming plane that he thought was headed right for them. And he believed that that was the military plane that had just been mentioned, and it wasn't in their vicinity, it was heading right for them. So he had to take evasive maneuvers. He heaves the control stick forward, plunged the aircraft 400 foot towards the ground, and flung passengers all over the fuselage. 16 of them were injured in the eventual maneuver. He quickly righted the plane. There was no collision. And at that point, he realized that the light that he saw wasn't a plane heading straight for them. It was the planet Venus.
Of course, they're heading straight for them.
Yeah, yeah.
That was not on Venus's flight plan.
Oh no. My God. What? One could say that it was a Venus fly trap.
Oh, drop that mic this fucking instant.
Podcast over. Done.
Podcast over. Wow.
Obviously, an astonishing oversight, and it cost the airline $20 million in a class action lawsuit from all of the passengers. Understandably, and I presume from offended Venusians going, who would never dream of doing such a thing.
Was it a first class or an economy class lawsuit?
Is Venus so, like, does it flash that much?
It's a shiny planet, yeah. Oh. Airplanes tend to flash their lights at each other in the same way, like, drivers of cars sometimes, like, to wink or wave at each other. So, right. yeah, apparently, when they're passing each other from a distance. They don't pull over, wind the window down, and have a chat, though, like some bus drivers in London.
Wow.
That is amazing. Your Venus flytrap. I love it.
I know. It's just remarkable.
Unbelievable. And did he carry on working?
That I don't know, but I would imagine not.
Became an astronaut.
Yeah. Our nominees for the world's worst pilot are Barry's creator of the horse balloon, Pierre Testud-Brissy. David's nomination of Major William Martin, the man who never was, well, actually was, but never was a pilot, but did help us win the war. And mine of the Venus dodging sleepyhead. So I'm going to say, David, much as I admire this mad story, I'm going to discount yours because yours basically was the world's worst pilot because he wasn't a pilot.
Yeah. Fair.
And great story, wonderfully inspirational, but I'm not really feeling it.
And so kind of the world's best pilot in many ways, while also not being a pilot.
Which leaves it between a man who tried to make a horse fly. So
you're right, Ben. I should win. You're right.
Well, no, because I'm going to say that your guy. He's less of a pilot and more of an aeronautical innovator because it's the horse that was the pilot. And I don't know whether that horse the balloon was attached to was any better or worse than a horse in charge of an F-15.
I feel like I might know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
I so now want to see. So, listeners, listen, some of you have artistic skills. I want a mocked up picture of a horse in a flight suit with the hooves around a cockpit ASAP.
Yes, please. Whereas mine, of all the catastrophic things that one can do whilst flying a plane, mistaking an object millions of miles away from where you are to cause you to do evasive manoeuvres, I think is one of the worst you can do. So I'm going for mine, lads. I'm sorry, I can't see
that's
anything
fine.
To beat it.
I think that's absolutely right.
Fair, yeah.
Good. So before we go, we're going to have some of the best news of the week. And we are going all the way to the Old Forge pub, which is in Inverary in Manage, in the very west of Scotland. And this is Britain's remotest pub, which has just been saved by a community ownership scheme. It was going to close down, but after a mammoth 14-month fundraising effort that raised over £320,000, it is now owned by the Old Forge Community Benefit Society. So it's on the Noidart Peninsula in Western Scotland. And yeah, it's absolute middle of nowhere and serves only the community and clearly struggled for custom, but is enough of an important community asset that they have joined together and made sure that it can be maintained to keep the local social culture and economic sustainability a thing of the future. And that pleases me.
Nice. Pub crawl?
Yeah, pub hike.
Yeah.
Do we know how far away it is? from other? Is it the remotest in the sense from any the next?
Any other pub? Or good question. I don't know on what grounds it is the most remote, but it is in the Guinness Book of Records, and I trust them to not yank our chains when it comes to the remoteness of remote pubs.
It's an 18-mile hike or a 7-mile sea crossing to get there. So yeah, it's not exactly a short pop down from your house of an evening.
There you go.
Oh, happy days.
Yeah.
So before we go, David, where can our listeners find you and what will they find you doing when they get there?
So you can see me and my band of merry musical theatre idiots in Operation Mincemeat at the Riverside Studios in Hammersmith. We will be there from the 28th of April through to the 9th of July. Come down for a lovely afternoon by the river, get a pint, come watch this show. And it's an absolute laugh riot. There is no whale cheese in it, but you can at least imagine yourself dining on some whilst you watch it.
Yeah, I have been to see it twice already. I am definitely going back at least once, if not twice, during the run. It's I cannot recommend it highly enough. You've had me banging on about my stuff on this podcast before. Operation Mincemeat is better.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Good. Marvellous stuff. Well, we're all off to pop on a milkmaid's outfit and go to SeaWorld with a hope and a dream. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.